Blog Talk Radio.
Home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen, coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Everybody, welcome to Rated G Radio. We've got a fun show for you tonight. You're going to be hearing an interview I did yesterday afternoon with Stephen Fales. He's the star of Confessions of a Mormon Boy, which is selling out like crazy here in Los Angeles at the Zephyr Theater. You'll hear me plug it several times, but it's at the Zephyr Theater this Sunday night, 7 p.m., Los Angeles. Buy your tickets online. There's a link to buying your tickets on the show page. You can hear that tonight. After the interview with Stephen, we're going to play a song or two, and then we're going to get to a recent interview I did with Jim O'Hare, star of NBC's Parks and Recreation. That show just came to a conclusion. He's out pounding the pavement now, raising money for an independent film he's spearheading called Middleman. Fun interview with Jim. So you've got two stars back to back to back. So thank you for being part of the show tonight. Also want to thank our guest Monday night, Annie Ulrich, for being our energy informer for the month of March. Thank you very much, Annie. Last night we had Justin with, he was from the Gold Coast of Australia. He's talking about liquid crystals. Tomorrow night we have celebrity chef John Polk, and Friday we've got Nicole, and she is a top 10 Billboard recording artist, and we're going to be playing all of her hits on Friday night at 7. 2-hour show on Friday night. That's really cool. Here's your interview with Stephen Fales, star of Confessions of a Mormon Boy. Enjoy it, and I'm live with you tonight chatting on Facebook and also Blog Talk. So if you want to sit there and carry on with me while the interview is going on, send me a note. I will chat with you. Enjoy.
Stephen Fales, who is the star of Confessions of a Mormon Boy, we are sitting outside of Wolfgang Puck's Bistro here in Orange County today. This is totally the place to do an interview, and I'm so excited to have you back on the show.
Hey, it's March 3rd, and it's
it is.
Yeah.
Well, it will be. And what, you know. By the time this airs, it'll be March 4th, and there we go. No, we're good.
Okay, good, good, good. Hi,
TV.
I'm the Mormon Boy.
We just keep
here
talking.
We are at South Coast Plaza. It's March 3rd or 4th or something like that, and it's like the sun is out, and it's like the most glorious weather. Orange County, who would have thought?
Well, yesterday, you know, we had all that hail and rain and all of that. Did you get any where you're at?
Well, we had a lot of rain, but it totally rained on my opening night on Sunday night.
Well, let's
and
talk
on
about
the preview.
That.
It was like crazy.
So I don't know where the rest of the people in the country are listening from, but in Los Angeles the last 3 or 4 months, we've had more rain here than we've had, I think, historically in the last million years. And it's all coming down, you know, usually about the time 7 or 8 o'clock on a Saturday night or a Sunday night, right about the time that you want to go see a great play like Confessions of a Mormon Boy at the Zephyr Theater in Los Angeles. And that was certainly the case this past week. Tell us about the
show.
Well,
you don't understand. What they say is that Angelenos don't drive when it rains. If it sprinkles, no one is driving at all. So Sunday night is my opening night. 7 o'clock at night, which is it's kind of a school night anyway, and that's why I've made it at 7, so that by 8:30 you can get home in time to get to bed for your, get up at 5 for your, pilot or whatever you're doing. Whatever they do in Los Angeles.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm, spend too much time in New York. But, like, it was downpour.
It was crazy.
And everyone came to see the show. We were turning people away on a Sunday night.
Yeah.
It was like the greatest gift, and it was the most delicious audience I performed for in years. Remember the laughter?
I will tell you. Number one, let's talk about the audience, because when I got there, and I was there about 15 minutes before the show started, I think I got one of the last two or three seats in the entire theater, and I was lucky because these two people took pity upon me to let them sit in between them. But I was very grateful for the opportunity to be there. But the crowd was crazy. You had all kinds of dignitaries there, from Dennis Hensley.
We had the dean of UCLA's theater film school, theater film and television. We had Allison Arngrim of
Little House on the Prairie. Yeah.
Nellie, who does her show Confessions of a Prairie Bitch.
I need to see that.
It's a one-woman show, and her book is amazing.
Okay.
So she's done the Confessions of a Prairie Bitch. I've done Confessions of a Mormon Boy, and finally, we got to meet.
There we go.
Yeah.
You have a great picture with her, too.
Yeah. It's on Facebook. You can check it out.
So what's your play about?
Confessions of a Mormon Boy is the story of being the perfect Mormon, doing all the Mormon rites of passage, all the Mormon milestones, and having this same-sex attraction all the time. But then I get married tell my ex-wife before we get married that I'm gay. Of course, her dad was gay, so it's all really interesting. And her mother wrote a national bestseller about bringing her ex-husband home to die of AIDS. So I married into this family where business, the family business was gay Mormon memoir anyway. So after my excommunication, my divorce, losing custody of the kids all in one breath, I kind of went crazy and I didn't realize it. So I moved to New York, where all of my networking had been, because I had been I was in grad school in Connecticut. So all of my connections were in the theater in New York. So I sat on my ex-wife and the kids up in Happy Valley, Utah, and I'm going to commute back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I don't know how I'm going to afford it, but I know I'm going to go for my dreams, and I start to take a big shortcut. My life spirals out of control when I become a full-time escort.
Wow.
So when we take shortcuts, our real dreams elude us.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than working on the play I was going to write about my excommunication, rather than focus on the soap opera auditions I was thinking I was meant to do, rather than be in the chorus of Les Mis or other shows that I had trained to do my whole life, I was dabbling in crystal meth.
Ugh.
And all the sex that comes with that. So about 9 months into my double life in New York, and granted I made a lot of money, trading in my Payless shoes for Prada, flying across the country, flying the kids back and forth, but living this double life, and my light was going. So I woke up and had this aha, and I realized that I was looking for my father's love and money in the penthouses of New York. And I was playing the victim. So as long as I could blame the church, or my parents, or Emily, my ex-wife, or anybody else, I would justify doing whatever I wanted. And that was self-destructing. So we tell this story of extremes, from perfect Mormon boy to perfect rent boy, to finding a middle ground. We have a dramatic reveal at the end that signals the start of a path of transformation. But it's not preachy, we just tell what it's like to be a gay Mormon, and it seems to translate universally to other faiths and other experiences. So, Confessions of a Mormon Boy is part one in the Mormon Boy trilogy.
So, you're playing every Sunday night at the Zephyr Theater, now through the end of April, and at 7 p.m. on Sunday night.
Yeah.
What else do people need to know?
Well, you can go to the website, which is MormonBoyOnline.
Okay.
And .com. And the tickets are at Brown Paper Tickets, Mormon Boy at Brown, you know, go to the website, it'll make it at the ticketing agency. But we're LA Times Critics' Choice, and we got a Go in the LA Weekly. So I think you'll find that it's worth your money. And it's directed by Tony Award winner Jack Hopsis of The Elephant Man.
Nice. Yeah. You got everybody helping you here. So when I went to go see the play on Sunday night, I really wasn't sure what to expect. We've talked before. You've been on the show before. I've listened to your London recording before. I was telling Stephen before, I said, I think I've listened to it 948 times. I rounded up to 1,000. But
oh, my gosh. Yeah. Thank you so much. No, no one's ever listened to it more than you. I think that's so amazing.
It's a great story, but I will tell you, even listening to it all the different times, I had no clue what I was in for when you hit the stage. Hearing it on a CD, hearing you on the telephone is much different than seeing it live and in person. And to see all the things that went right with the show, and we had maybe a couple of things that weren't
Oh, we
so
had
perfect.
The main light that I need, this God light, completely go out. And so, but we made fun of it the whole night, and the crowds were going crazy about it.
They went nuts. Everybody, at the end of it, I think they go, I loved everything Stephen did, and the God light.
You know, yeah, can you keep that mistake? Can you keep it? I'll try.
It's crazy. From a performer standpoint, because you've now performed this worldwide, you've taken it on tour every place you played off-Broadway with it.
I played London, I played Halifax, Nova Scotia, I played Houston, I played... we're reviving it here in L.A.
So you've done this now, you know, once or twice. You've been around the block here. How do you take a play that you have written for yourself and keep this something that's really fresh and exciting and something that you can go out and give 1,000% every single night?
You know, it is going to sound... I hope it doesn't sound too new agey or stuff, but, you know, around performance 600, it does start to get old and tired.
Yeah.
And you believe in the message, and something in me had to switch. And so it was almost as if before I went on stage, I would say a little bit of a prayer. It's like praying to the God, saying, reveal something about my story to me that I didn't know before. Something in, you know, I think a lot happens in the white space of our lines. It's in the stillness of things. So, anyway, I would kind of go out like, let this be a meditation, and let me learn something about myself that I didn't know that were possible. But I find that it's really possible to learn something new about your material if you go into that really open for that experience. Otherwise, it becomes really stale, really sing-songy, really patterny,
and it's not that.
And you lose the freshness.
Yeah.
The other thing is, I had a lot of perfectionism coming into solo performance. I was trying to do this perfectly, like it was Shakespeare, or sing it perfectly, like it was a musical.
Yeah.
And when you're just trying to be yourself and be real, you have to let that perfectionism go. So let there be a little mistake. Let there be something rough about it today. Let me not do it perfectly. And I find that the less I do it perfectly,
the more perfect.
It turns out perfect.
Yeah. Well, every blink, every smile, every gesture, it just seems so perfectly timed. Not to say that you're psychic perfection, but it was something that you would see once and be really impressed with how smooth and how fantastic and just brilliant this whole performance is. It's something that I would go back and see Sunday after Sunday after Sunday.
Really?
If it doesn't rain next time. You know.
Might it be better then?
Yeah, that might be better if it doesn't rain. But I've seen other live performances before, and it looks painful. And yours looks so effortless and easy. And even though the story was painful at times, it was funny at times, it was heart-wrenching, you are captivated that entire time and want to know more. It's like, what happened next? It's never like, ugh.
I love telling this story.
Yeah.
And I know what it does for people. I know it's entertaining. We hope to make a difference, and I've seen this play make huge differences in people's lives. I'm still on a mission.
Yeah.
So I hadn't done it since my run in Philadelphia, really. I did it in Philly last August. So I'm actually very hungry to be back on stage. I was doing a lot of other things and writing and kids and family. And now I'm in L.A., and I'm like, get me back on that stage. And the audience was delicious.
Just fantastic. Yeah. Everybody there was a huge fan. And it's hardly surprising because if your Facebook following, and I told people I was coming to see the show, and they're like, I want to go. And it's like, it's sold out. You can't get tickets this Sunday. You got to go next week. Maybe you tell me, and I'll go with you, and we'll sell it out again. But just a fantastic show. So you've got other things that you're working on. You've got two more.
Well, this is the Mormon Boy trilogy. So part two is called Missionary Position,
Okay. Which
is actually the prequel. More about my mission to Portugal.
Oh, wow.
And then part three is very serious. It's pretty much a courtroom drama. It's the sequel. It's called Prodigal Dad.
Mm.
And I did all three of these shows in repertory in Virginia last year.
Wow.
And the good news is that the Washington Post gave me a rave review. So that gives me a lot of courage that I can continue to polish it and take it to New York in 2016. So what we're trying to do is revive Confessions for its 10-year anniversary revival off-Broadway.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
With the other two shows. With the book called Oxymormon Memoirs, the hardback, which is a film, and the documentary film Mormon Boy, as well as all the other spin-offs. So I've been writing in...
You got a franchise here.
We do. And then the cabaret act called Mormon American Princess.
Oh, yeah.
We do that cabaret. And then I've got an album I'm working on called Mormon American Cowboy.
What about an apparel line?
Let's do Mormon Boy jeans. When you're wearing Mormon Boy, you wear the truth. Let's do the jewelry. I don't know. What else can we do? The cooking show?
You have your underwear.
Yeah, we do the Mormon Boy cooking show. How about that?
I love that.
Right?
Where are you going to cook, Jell-O?
Jell-O, and I'll tell Jell-O stories.
Jell-O stories?
Yeah, even Jell-O shots.
Okay. There we go. There we go.
It's nice to be back in L.A. where everyone has working on their creative empire.
Mm-hmm.
They may not call it an empire, but I like to call it that. But it's like we take a room, we're building a house. And the foundation of my creative thing is Confessions of a Mormon Boy. It's what everything centers around. And then we build on that. And pretty soon you have all this property, and you lift it to the next level. And then you welcome everyone into your house.
Yeah.
to take a look.
I love it. So, if we step back, can we kind of go like behind the scenes as a performer and what it takes as a one-man show to kind of like take this to a new city? Like, even though you've performed it here before, it's probably been a hot minute. You know, what's your process when you decide, okay, I'm going to throw a dart, and oh, it's L.A. this time? And
well, sometimes people ask me to come.
Okay.
You know, often the show books itself.
Yeah.
That's really great. When that happens, I'm usually holed up, you know, in the place I'm, like, I've been in Salt Lake for a lot of years, so I'll be in my place in Salt Lake, historically, and it's time to leave and get on the flight, and it's like, I resist in a certain level, because I know what it takes to tell the story.
Yeah.
It takes up so much, you know, and I do care, but it's physically a lot. But once I get on the flight, I turn into Mormon Boy.
Ah.
And I come to the new city, I have all this energy, it's like this missionary, I just like, you know, and when I come in, I'm in charge of, I'm basically the director, the lighting designer, everything, and I give them everything we got, and I do that, and then I come out, and there's the press, and all of that, and we do it, and then I make all these friends, and I go home.
And you go home.
And I decompress for about 2 days. I've learned that I have to take care of myself after a big effort. Because I'm one of those people that thinks that he has to be busy all the time. So I have to, even if I'm in a field pulling weeds, I have to take downtime.
So besides pulling weeds, what do you consider downtime activities? What's something that you just love and can't wait to do?
Anything with my kids.
Okay.
I just never can get enough of my kids.
Well, let's talk about it. How old are they?
Yeah, let's talk about it. They're like totally the biggest reason I do what I do.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote Confessions because I was afraid if I were to die, there wouldn't be anyone to tell my story to my young children. Now my kids are 18 and 20. Almost.
Get out!
Right?
Oh my gosh!
I was a curious 9-year-old.
I'm telling you. Way to go. Okay.
So, you know, I'll be having grandkids in 10 years at least.
Yeah.
The latest, I'm sure. So, anything with my kids, I like to hike.
Yeah.
I like to, I don't do enough going to see movies. And so when I take myself to a movie, I'm really treating myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I do get tired of my own story, believe it or not.
You know, you've told it once or twice, you know.
So I do like to travel. What's really nice is when I get to go to places and it becomes like a working vacation.
Yeah.
So I really enjoy Philly. I'd never been to Philly, really.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
and so
gosh.
I got to go see things, and they did the Rocky Steps. And so I do like to take in, you know, the sights.
Yeah.
I love to see other solo performers and support them in their work. You know what? There's probably more I could do to decompress. I'm very driven, but I have to. Sometimes I confuse being driven with being busy.
Sure.
And I'm not always
being
effective.
Yeah.
Busy is not always effective.
Yeah. How do you organize your time, if that's the case?
I
suffer from that too. So it's, you know.
When I'm on the road and things, I crave routine. I really do. I really need it. But I guess in the morning, an ideal day would be get up and coffee and kind of say some prayer to the universe and say, what's going to happen today? Let's do it. And then a lot of faith. My life is becoming more and more social media.
Yeah.
I can't believe how much time that takes. I have Instagram,
mm-hmm.
which is Mormon Boy. What is it? It's a new Instagram. Oh my gosh, I had to beef it up because everyone's on Instagram now,
yeah.
right?
Yep.
And then there's Twitter. So on Twitter, I'm Mormon Boy. On Instagram, I'm on at Mormon Boy Live. Facebook, the Mormon Boy page is Mormon Boy Live, the new website. But, you know, I'm great at Facebook. I'm really bad at Twitter. I've got to get better at that.
Well, do you have your setup where once you post to Facebook, it also goes to Twitter?
A little bit.
A little bit.
That's
okay.
Like that Hootsuite thing, right?
I don't know. I think there's a setting on Twitter that you click and it magically connects
yeah.
all of
I'm
that.
Doing a little bit more of that. But
I know.
Anyway, sometimes I have a great big team because
right,
the budget allows,
right.
and then sometimes it's all back on me.
Right.
So I'm putting together more and more of a team.
Yeah.
so that I can be more and more the artist.
Yeah.
I believe that the future belongs to those who produce what they create. More and more that will be the case.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not involved in the producing, you know, you're going to lose out on the money, and more people are self-producing, so you can't wait around for someone to discover you. But at the same time, to go to another level, if you don't have a team, there's no possible way that you can and be the creative.
Right.
So more and more I need to pass it over to people that are my you know, the team that lets me do what I do, and that is fly on stage. And you saw me fly the other night.
Yeah, oh my gosh. What a huge treat. So everybody, you're listening to Stephen Fales, he's the star of Confessions of a Mormon Boy, playing at the Zephyr Theater up in Los Angeles, Sunday night, 7 p.m. Get your tickets today and go treat yourself to a fantastic 90-minute show. And you can call back and thank me later, because you absolutely will. Okay. So, as an artist, that's talking about needing to be creative, where do you draw inspiration from to be creative now? Because you've done your Mormon trilogy, you've got a CD, you've got some other things that you were telling me before we got started today that I can't wait to see. Where is your well? Where do you draw from?
Well, first of all, I get inspired by other artists that are doing, like, they have what they have going, like you.
Yeah.
I mean, you have your music, you have, you know, your music videos you're working on, you're like, you're making it happen, I'm like, oh, I can do that. Like I'm like, I've got this song,
mm-hmm.
that I can see the music video in my head, so I'm like, I totally want to see his music video and see how it's going. It's not that I want to copy.
Yeah, but you get inspiration. Yeah,
I get inspiration from other creatives.
Yeah.
And I've evolved in my different themes, and so I'm kind of thematic in what I'm interested in, and then I riff on it. So, for example, if I'm going to write a show now called Cult Model about, you know, cults and my own cult susceptibility, and I get obsessed with this, and I just start thinking about all the cults that have been in my life, and what is a cult, and what are cult characteristics, and what are the good things about cults, and what are the bad things, and what are the songs, and I have the cult rap, and then I have this parody of, you know, all of a sudden you're like, I've been alive forever, and I formed the very first cult. And you take a Barry Manilow song, and you, like, twist it, and you're like, and all of a sudden you just let yourself be creative, and it just starts to fall and flow, and then I just love the creative life. You can use anything.
So, I'm big on time blocking. If I don't have you blocked on my calendar, it just doesn't happen. And so, like, today, when I knew we were going to meet for lunch, I blocked out this period of time, and as soon as I leave here, I've got my next thing. I struggle booking creative time. So it's like, I know for some things I'm working on now, I've got some things that I'm way overdue on.
Mm-hmm.
You say, okay, I'm going to be creative today at 10 a.m. And
I procrastinate all the time.
Okay.
I procrastinate. I mismanage my time. I do all kinds of insane things that postpone and make it work hard, but I also do a lot of good things.
Yeah.
So one of the things I do is I have switched my thinking. I have lists that are so long that it would be impossible for me or my team to ever check everything off in a day.
Yeah.
So I accept that it's impossible to finish everything. So I pat myself on the back for every little thing I do. So I have a to-done list. You know, people have a to-do list?
I like that.
So I have a to-done list. So I write down what I do every day. I did this. I brushed my teeth.
Oh, wow.
Good boy.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's as basic as that.
But it's a great place to start.
Oh, and it's a much healthier place to be
because
you're living in this positive energy and you're, you know, we're shame and we're so hard on ourselves and we shame ourselves and it's never good enough or never enough and there's never enough time. It's like, oh, I worked on this for 15 minutes today. Oh, yeah, good, good.
Yeah.
Or I had a wonderful interview today, you know. So I do a to-done list, and easy does it, accomplishes it, so I take it easy, and I do not burn the midnight oil.
Well,
I'm not...
For everybody who's listening to this, Steven looks like he's about 18 or 19 years old and has not had anything done ever. And you can see the sparkle in his eyes and on his teeth. It's a good thing I have sunglasses on right now because the sparkles would just blind anybody. You'd think it's diamond.
Oh, you are so too kind.
But it's clear you don't burn the midnight oil. Because if you did...
Oh, no, 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 no.
You would have
well,
a completely
thank
different...
you, thank you. But I decided in grad school that if it didn't get done by midnight...
Didn't get done.
We're going to bed.
Wow.
That's the rule.
Okay.
Basically, that's how I live my life.
Yeah.
And then it will get done in the morning.
Yeah.
Because nothing can get done. If I get sick...
Yeah. It does.
It won't happen.
It's not going to happen.
Right. And I... And about 6 o'clock at night, my creativity... I'm a morning person.
Okay.
My creativity shuts down about 6 o'clock at night.
Okay.
And then I can coast out the night. And it's not because I'm drinking. That's not
right.
the case.
Right, right.
It's just because...
You know that.
My creativity peaks in the morning.
So when you decide that you're going to have a creativity peak in the day, are you sitting down at a computer to write, or are you in a park with a notebook? What do you, how do you?
Well, I do have a writer's notebook, you know, and I'll grab it if a song hits.
Yeah.
I never know when it could hit, you know, and if it did hit at midnight, I'd stay up till 1. I would stay up. like the idea for the song, come back to it in the morning.
Yeah.
So, what was it? Wait, tell me that question again.
So,
my thoughts race.
How do you get creative, or where do you get creative? How do you do it? Are you at your desk? Are you at a notebook?
Well, it all depends on the deadline.
Okay.
And so, as a self-produced artist, I have to inflict self-imposed deadlines upon myself. And when I know I have an opening night, then I have to budget the time that will accomplish the task. So, like, if I know I'm going to write a new show, there will be several developmental runs. So I take the pressure off, too. It's like this new cult model show.
Right.
I'm going to do the Hollywood Fringe. Maybe 2 or 3 nights. Nothing at stake. Try it out.
Easy.
See what's going on.
Yeah.
Nothing big.
Yep.
I think it's going to do well. And take it to the next level. And then, maybe I do it in a few other places. And then all of a sudden, boom, becomes this commercial thing, and I'm the next Margaret Cho with Cult Model. Don't think that Margaret Cho, you know, films one of her new shows without having tried it out in some little club that doesn't matter. Nothing, not that it doesn't matter, little club. We love you. But we love you because we can sail there
without.
It's such a fun life.
Yeah.
It being creative, it's so. I feel blessed that I went for it, or that you're going for it.
Well, I think one of the things that I'm so impressed with you is that you really have had such you've had such a creative, colorful past in a lot of aspects. You got to go see the show at the Zephyr Theater Sundays at 7 o'clock now through the end of April. Confessions of Mormon book, and get your tickets. Should we talk about parking too? We'll talk about that.
Yes, we must talk about parking in LA.
The fact that you have had a different background career-wise while you were trying to pursue the creative work that you were doing.
Well, you have to remember that I was perfect.
You were
up
perfect.
Until I was 30.
Okay.
I had 2 kids, 2 degrees, Eagle Scout, all those things. Then life got really crazy,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then I reclaimed my life by writing, and life continues. So I guess, you know, we've all done things. Not everyone comes clean about it on stage, nor do they need to.
Right, yeah.
But, I guess the miracle of the whole thing is that I'm still alive, and that after what I've been through,
mm-hmm.
that I have this this ability to share it. I don't know. It's just like my life and my art came to this dynamic place. Had I not done the experiences in Shakespeare and musicals, I wouldn't have the confidence to be on stage. I don't know that I could articulate, but I just seem to be this place where I have a message to share. And I guess as a Mormon boy growing up, I was taught to make a difference, and I can't think of it. And my way is now through the arts. If there's a cult I belong to, it's the cult of the theater and the performing arts today. It's the temple of humanism, where all stories are welcome.
Yeah.
And I feel part of the human race, and that's I feel like I come home.
Well, last words, before, because you've already given us your social media things. By the way, if you're listening to the show, I'll have all the links to Stephen's things, where to buy his CD, where to go buy your tickets for the show. All of that will be there, so just click whichever respective link is there. And if you can't find it, let either of us know, and we'll make sure that you show up this Sunday night at the Zephyr Theater. I'm sorry to keep
plugging,
but
please.
7 p.m. Zephyr Theater in Los Angeles. Parking, I will tell you, is a nightmare, especially if it's raining. So you said there's a little-known...
There's a restaurant called Antonio. It does valet parking. I don't think it's for too much, but it's right next door to the Zephyr Theater on Melrose. So you can use Antonio's valet.
Okay.
It's they're in cahoots to help each other. I think there are other restaurants that will valet for the theater as well.
Okay.
There are two streets nearby that I need to find out what these are, but they're unmetered.
Oh, nice.
Unmetered parking. So there is absolutely parking. You just need to know. And actually, I'm going to put all of that on the ticketing site.
Oh, cool.
So it's very clear. It's going to be in block letters, parking instructions, so that you feel confident that there is a parking spot for you, and I was assured that there is.
And so, everybody, I hope to see you Sunday night. Can I ask you, do you have any shout-outs you want to give to family or friends or people that might be listening tonight?
Yeah, I want to say hey to my kids.
Okay.
Easy up there in Salt Lake City. My son's in college and he's a singer-songwriter. My daughter's this amazing, talented actress and cello player and academic wonder child who's finishing up her senior year. And I can't wait to see you come to Disneyland and come to Papa.
There we go. And then your story about your experiences growing up in the Mormon church and just trying to be that perfect person, and I love the stories that you tell in there, really touched me. But for people who are out there either struggling with something, whether it's addiction or sexuality or family issues or whatever, do you have any words of advice that you might share with folks before we end?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I want you to leave this interview with what is possible for you. And if you live in what's possible, anything is possible.
There we go.
And say yes to your dreams and take those little tiny steps. If all it is brushing your teeth today, just brush your teeth. Be compassionate with yourself, and take the next right step.
There we go. Everybody, it's been Stephen Fales. Go see his play on Sunday night, and we will be right back after this.
Tell my mother I loved her the most. Tell my father, I know he did his best. Tell my love, who broke my heart, I never stopped loving them. Tell my sister she should have been a poet. And tell my brother how guilty I felt when I ran off from home to chase all my dreams. But I left him back there to pick up the pieces. What you gonna do, what you gonna say, and what you gonna give? What you gonna give, what you gonna give, and what you gonna give?
Welcome back to the show. As I've been telling you all week long, we have got the star of stage and screen, Jim O'Hare, joining the show today to talk about a new project that he's in, but you'll always remember him from his show Parks and Recreation, and I have questions about his Christmas movie. It looks like a legacy that he's starting to build right now as well. But Jim, welcome to Rated G Radio. How are you today?
Good, Garrett. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited that you are here. You and I met back in December at the TMI show up at TMI Hollywood, and
yeah.
Was that something that was new and exciting for you? Is that something you've done before,
Garrett? As far as done before, I've certainly I trained at Second City and that kind of thing. But I
sure.
had no idea what I was in for. Because John Barra, contacted
yeah.
me because he kind of handles the booking of the guest house, I guess. And he said, would you do it? And it was just, the timing is the tough part always to commit to
right.
because of, bookings and all this kind of stuff. Well, finally, he said, listen, if you can come take a look at it. I went and the host was Dot Jones.
Yeah.
And so I went and saw it, and I thought, wow, that looks really scary, but it kind of looks fun. But I'm going to blow this off, and I'll tell him I'll do it after the new year. So
right.
I'm like, John, and I wasn't lying. I had a lot of stuff going on. So I get it like an emergency message from him saying, listen, some people from Second City Chicago are coming in town. There's any way you could do it this one particular Sunday. And I thought, oh, hell, okay. And I said yes. And I tell you, here's what's amazing. They do that show every week. And every week, every scene is new. Every scene is topical. I was blown away by every
very
aspect
talented.
Of it. They're a talented group of people,
yeah.
writers, directors, the whole thing. I was blown away.
It's such a cool show to see, and it's like you said, it's fresh every week. So I don't get up there every week, but I try to go as often as I can because
yeah.
it's just a fun look at the week's events, and you see so many talented people there. So John, from TMI, of course, is a dear friend of mine, and I think he's just the cat's pajamas. But having you on, everybody after the show, which is what really I just found so inspiring about what you were doing during your performances. Everybody's like, Jim was great, Jim was great, Jim was great, and I know that. You were saying, well, I don't know about this or that, and everybody's like, he was magical.
Oh,
so
gosh,
it was,
I know.
Yeah.
Well, you know what it is? They go out of their way to make the host look good. So, I give them all the credit because just to give people an idea of what happens, on Friday night, you're sent, I think it was 50 or 60 pages of material
wow.
that they're going to do over they're going to do these scenes. Now, you're certainly not in on every page, you're not in every scene, but as the host, they put you, in a chunk, in a nice big chunk.
Yeah.
And that weekend also happened to be the Parks and Recreation wrap. That's when we wrapped up. Oh, actually, that reminds me. The reason I thought this timing was good, I thought it would take my mind off of, that Parks was just wrapping
yeah.
up, and it gave me something else to think about. So, but the Saturday night was our big wrap party, which I knew would be a little booze, a little food, all that kind of stuff. So I didn't know how much free time I would have. So Friday
right.
night I get these scripts. I'm like, holy cow, this is a lot of material. And you have to know it. It's not like there's no cue cards. This isn't,
right.
there's no monitors. There's, you got to know this stuff. But you go to rehearsal on Saturday. You meet the nicest group of people who go out of their way to make you look good. They know them. I mean, they're learning the material too, but you can tell they're focused on making the host look good. So I couldn't have been more appreciative. And so Saturday at one point I said, I don't think this can come together by tomorrow. I just don't think this is physically possible. And the one, I forget which one of the guys it was, and he goes, oh, feels this way every week, and then somehow it comes together. And that's exactly what happened. As much as I was like, this can't happen, there's no way that these 20 scenes are going to be in front of a crowd tomorrow. This is not physically possible. We
mm-hmm.
did it, and I don't think anyone messed up a line. I think It seemed flawless. You know, they were much better than I was, but they made me look good, which was just very lovely of them.
Well, and speaking, well, so TMI Hollywood, want to send mad props out to you guys, but speaking of your cast party that you're wrapping up the day before, so everybody knows you from your role as Jerry on Parks and Recreation, and I asked some people right before the show, I said, if you've got any questions for, you know, Jim to ask about his experience on there, send them on in. So I've actually got a couple from the listeners out there that they're going to hear this a little bit later this week. Is it? Can I ask you a couple of questions about your time?
Absolutely.
Did you want the part of Jerry, or did you audition for other parts before you were cast in that role?
Well, you know, when the word came out that Amy Poehler was going to do a show, because she had left Saturday Night Live,
mm-hmm.
so she was a hot property. And I think NBC wanted to keep her in the family because she was, you know, NBC Saturday Night Live. And so the word was out she's going to do a show with the co-creator of actually the creator of the American version of The Office, Greg Daniels. So it was kind of like, wow, Amy Poehler's having a show. That's going to be a big deal. So now it comes time they're going to cast it. So basically what they did was they put out for the role of Ron Swanson. So everybody and their brother read for the role of Ron
sure.
Swanson, which the thought of anyone else doing it other than Nick Offerman, like, just makes no sense.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, in any realm, it makes no sense. And ultimately, he was always their choice. But the way these networks run, they want you to see everybody. It's a process, you know, it's the whole thing. So I'm a big believer in just being prepared for an audition because as an actor, that's my job. You know, like, I don't go into an audition unless I'm prepared, which that doesn't mean I don't screw up sometimes because, you know, that's human nature. But in general, I'm prepared because you never know who's in the room and what they might see
right.
and what they're casting
yeah.
next week or next month or something. So I went there. I did my interpretation of Ron Swanson, which was different than Nick's.
Mm-hmm.
So mine was more stern, but a little less strident, or, you know, just a different take. But apparently they liked something they saw, because I think it was 2 weeks later, my agent called and said, they want to see you for a different role. Would you want to go in? I said, of course. So I go in for Jerry, and when I got to the room, to the audition area, there was, you know, again, a ton of people and different types, body types. I'm like, oh, boy, you know, so they don't
uh-huh.
know exactly what they're looking for. So I went in the room, I did the Jerry thing, and then, you know, as an actor, you got to let auditions go, because if you obsess over each and every one of them, you'd never sleep. You know, there's so many, and you have to learn early on that it's so out of your hands why you get cast or why you don't get cast. You might have given the best performance, but maybe you look too much like someone else, or maybe,
right.
who knows, there's a million reasons why
yep.
you do or don't get the job. So a couple weeks later, I get a call, and they said, oh, you booked Parks and Recreation, and I said, well, what did I book? Like, what role? And anyway, so it was Jerry. And they were very honest up front. They said, it's not a series regular. I found out later, Mike Shore and Greg Daniels, who ended up co-creating it, basically said, let's put him at a desk. We think it'll work. You know, we'll figure it out later.
Right.
So they hired me, and I never missed an episode. I didn't become a series regular, though, until season 3. So the first season was only 6 episodes, and then season 2 was a full season. So I became a full-on in season 3. So it was one of those things where they could have at one point said, you know what, this really isn't going to work, and you're done. You know, thank
right.
you for your time.
Yeah.
But my thought process the whole time was that these are the guys who worked on The Office, and look what happened to those guys. Your Kevin
right.
and your
yeah.
Phyllis's and Stanley and, you know, Angela's and all those people. So
great characters.
To me, it was great characters. They're beloved. You know, we love those characters. So to me, it was a pretty safe bet. That being said, it could have blown up and been like, no, this didn't work out. But luckily, very, very luckily it did. But when you hear stories, everybody read for different parts. Adam Scott had originally read for Mark Brandanowicz.
Wow.
I think Nick might have read for that role too. So it was all over the place. The only one that was offered the job, obviously Amy, but Aziz they wanted. There was no Aziz was a pick, and
okay.
they got a call from the casting director saying, "I just met the quirkiest girl. I want you to meet her." And Mike Shore says he met with Aubrey Plaza, and by the end of the meeting, he knew he had to have her cast, and he was afraid of her. And he'll tell you, 7 seasons later, he's still afraid of her. You know,
yeah,
in a
there
good
you go.
Way, in a good
in
way,
a good
very
way.
Loving way. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, that question came from Nolan, and he had a follow-up question: is how did the role change your life?
Wow. Oh, boy, Garrett. It changed in so many ways. You know, I mean, and just base facts, it changes your life financially. You know, to be a series regular changes things. I've been very, very blessed, and ever since I've moved to L.A. in 94, I've never had to do anything else, you know, to make a living. I've always made enough to live off of as an actor. But, you know, good years, bad years, some years really tight, you know, up and down. So it's security. You know, if nothing else, it gives you security. And we were very blessed. We made syndication, which means, you know, there'll be some, you'll see money from
nice
it as,
checks.
You know,
yep.
as years go on. Yeah, so that's awesome. But that's that little part of the world, which is, you know, people say, oh, money doesn't buy happiness. It absolutely doesn't, but it gives you some security. So that's one big thing that came from it. The other thing is it's opened up so many doors for my career. You know, my manager calls with offers sometimes rather than auditions. You know,
that's a nice change.
You know, that's a nice change. You know, I'm shooting Hot in Cleveland next week, or well, this week I guess it is, and they just called and said, we'd love to have Jim on our show. You know, so it's changed that. I have some films coming up that were offers. It's changed that. Now, that being said, I'm more than happy to audition as an actor. That's our job, like
sure.
I said earlier. So I don't mind going in and auditioning, but certain roles they're just going to offer now instead of making me go in. And that's a big change. And also I get to go to some good, cool parties.
That's always fun.
That's always
so
fun.
Out of all the episodes that you have filmed for Parks and Recreation, this is my last question. We'll move on to something else. Do you have a favorite episode or one that just really stands out in your mind?
Well, I have so many favorite episodes. Here's what I'm going to say about Parks that some people will agree or disagree. But the seasons, in my opinion, did nothing but get stronger. I don't think we had a weak season. And I can say that. I am not a writer. So that's not a bragging thing for me. I didn't do it. It wasn't because of me. But every season, I think it got stronger. So in season two, we did an episode called The Hunting Trip. And it was the first time all of us as a group were out in the world. We went on a hunting trip together. And I love that episode. It turns out Ron gets shot in the head with some weird stuff. And Retta, you know, who plays Donna, her Mercedes gets a hole in. I mean, I think everyone got to shine. And I just remember shooting it thinking, I'm living the dream this week. First of all, not knowing if we'd be on the air next month or not. You know, who knows,
right,
television.
Right.
But I remember thinking, I'm on a set with these amazing people. I have a chunk of the storyline. You know, as an actor, you love that you're part of a storyline. So I always say Hunting Trip. But then we had amazing, like the Harvest Festival episode where we made the Harvest Festival happen. Of course, I have personal favorites that I had good storylines in when I dropped a burrito and pretended I was mugged. And, you know, there's all that kind of stuff. But I can also tell this is for the diehard fans. I think the finale, and again, I'll have people disagree, will be the finest hour that people have seen in a long time. I really believe that. And it airs February 24th.
And that's just coming right up this next.
It's
well, I don't have a calendar, but it's coming up. So we'll make sure to tune in for that.
On Tuesday, it's an hour long. And what they did, how they are treating each character, is so lovely. And the thing about Parks is that I think is different from a lot of sitcoms. There's a lot of love in our show. There's a lot of.
Yeah.
It's okay to go to a commercial break without a big laugh. Everything wasn't liner. And believe me, I love sitcoms, so I don't mind those other shows, but I think this is what makes Parks different, that it wasn't all about laugh, laugh, laugh. And so I think what they've done with the, and I'm a big TV guy, I always have been, I think what they've done with the finale is unlike anything I've ever seen on a sitcom. So it'll be interesting. I'm dying to hear people's feedback because maybe I'm overstating it, but because I am very close to it, obviously. But it's awesome. It's just really awesome.
Well, I can't wait to see it. And I know everybody, when I said we're going to have Jim on from Parks and Rec, they started freaking out, and I'm getting private messages all over the place. So I have a feeling it'll set records for ratings, and I'm sure NBC will love that. Now, I'm going to say, you know, I looked up your IMDb page, and I had to take a nap about four times through the first page just from all of the work that you're doing. I was like, oh, poor Jim, you know, he's done with the series, the poor guy, you know, he's probably – and then I pull this up, and it's like, I don't think you've slept in about 15 years. So how do you have such a robust career? Because I know that if anybody's listening, you've seen Jim in millions of things. But the two things I really want to ask are about Naughty and Nice and My Santa – Because you worked with my friend Sam Ervin, who's the director for those.
Oh, you know Sam. I love Sam Ervin.
He's the best.
He's the best. He directed, I did a series, in, I think it was 2000, two seasons of a show called Strip Mall. And that's how I got to know Sam, because he directed a bunch of them.
Oh, there you go. Well, okay.
He's just a sweet man. Oh, my God, I love him.
So much fun. So are you now going to be Sam's official Christmas go-to guy when he gets ready to do his next film this next year? I'm assuming he's going to, you know, he's done like four of these now. So
exactly. Well, he has said that he needs me at least even for a moment in each one of them. He's calling me his good luck charm. I would love it. When Sam calls, I try to make it happen because he's the best. And people don't get it. But, I mean, people who are not in the, you know, who work on this day-to-day don't really understand. A director is so important to a project. It's their vision. And the tone that the director sets on a set is just so vital. And Sam is so even-keeled, and yet he puts out the fires. He handles the actors. He gives his notes. You know, maybe we do this, maybe we do that. But the tone and the feeling he puts on a set, you just want to work with him. He's one of the best.
Well, I love anything that the guy does, so I'll tell you that he's a favorite of mine, and then to be able to know him outside of his work, just a real treat. Now, the reason that I've asked you here today, though, and amidst your busy schedule, because we really had to kind of juggle and try to find time to fit you in, because you're a working actor, and you don't stop working, but you've got this fantastic new project called Middleman, and can you tell the listeners what that's all about?
Yeah, Middleman is a script that a friend of mine wrote a lot of years ago with me in mind, which was very awesome of him to do. His name is Ned Crowley, and he's a guy I knew in Chicago and did comedy with in Chicago, and we've been dear friends for, my God, going on 30 years. So last year he got back to me, you know, he was mentioned to me, he goes, I got this weird call, and there's these people who want to produce Middleman. And I said, wow, where did that come from? Like, wow, you know, I'm surprised. And he said, yeah, but only if you'll do it. And that made me even more surprised. Like, wow, that's very nice. So we met with these people, these producers, and we're going to do it. It's a low, you know, it's a low-budget indie. It's about a guy who has lived mostly with his grandmother. His parents died when he was young. He's lived with his grandmother, and he was raised on not today's comedians. He was more raised on Burns and Allen and Abbott and Costello, you know, those kind of
sure.
You know, he could, like how some people can, you know, lip sync to song, he can lip sync to every word of a Burns and Allen sketch or of Who's on First, you know, classic comedy stuff. So his grandmother always encouraged him, said that he was very funny. Well, he's not. He's not funny at all. But she passes away, and the only thing she had left to leave him was a car. It's this old, beautiful 58 Chevy. And he's going to, kind of in her honor, fulfill a lifelong dream, and he wants to go to Vegas and become a stand-up comic. There's a guy called Monty Guy who holds an annual comedy competition, and he's going to go there, and he's going to just, you know, take it by storm. Well, on the way there, he runs into a very mysterious hitchhiker, and things take a very bad turn. It's a very, very dark comedy. There's lots of blood. But it's funny and crazy. But he ends up being involved in things he never would even understand in his normal world, because he's just this sweet, innocent little guy, and now he's involved in murders and cover-ups and everything. So it's a very exciting film, and the script has gotten so much great attention that there's like name actors who want to be involved, which has been so exciting. You know, you get a call that so-and-so wants to be in the film. You're like, holy cow. So we can't release a lot of the names yet just because contracts haven't been signed, but there's,
right.
You know, as we joke in the promo for the Kickstarter campaign, we're like, famous people, you know, so which is exciting. My Parks family, of course, has been very supportive, and hopefully we'll see some of those faces. So it's a film that we're just so excited about, and I'm excited for many reasons. One of them, it's the anti-Jerry. You know, I've played this sweet, lovable man, you know, with this beautiful wife and family at home and all this on Parks for a lot of years. This is the anti-Jerry. This guy, you know, like I said, it turns into a bloodbath, and he has a love interest. So the movie we think it's going to be, we can shoot it in 25 days. It's a low budget indie, but we're doing a Kickstarter campaign to raise money. And people, a lot of times, and I totally understand this, people are like, well, you've been on a TV show. This should just be your money, blah, blah, blah. Here's what I say. It is my money, and it's Ned's money, and it's a lot of our money. We put a lot of money. Everyone's put money in.
Right.
We want to make a low-budget film look like a really big-budget film. So we did a Kickstarter campaign for another $150,000. So we started last week, and you can get some great things from it. You can have a walk-on in the film. You can go to premieres. God, for the big donation, I come to your house, and we have a pizza and beer party. So
you can't
as we
beat
watch
that.
The movie. Can't beat that. So that's to watch the movie. So it's just it's a way to keep people involved. You know, for their donation, they get to be involved in the film. There'll be emails. There'll be blogs every day. There'll be pictures, videos from me and the other stars that are going to be in it. The one guy I think I can talk about, and even though when I say this, I could be getting in trouble because I don't know if all the paperwork's done, but there's a guy named Andrew J. West, and he's from Walking Dead. And he's got a huge fan base. He's going to play my co-lead. And he's just amazing. We did a chemistry test a couple weeks ago, and wow, he's awesome. So super excited about that. And the woman who's going to play my the female interest in the film, I can't say her name yet. I'm dying to say it. I can't wait to say it, but I'm not
That's
allowed
okay.
to yet.
Okay.
But we'll be announcing on the Kickstarter page, we'll be announcing as these people are officially signed up, we'll be announcing their names, and then, you know, people can get excited.
And RJ wants to know, what have you got completed so far as filming? It looks like you've got a nice little start.
We've shot teasers. Yeah, no, we shot teasers to get – what we wanted to do with the teasers was to show people this is the style of this film. And the teaser, if you go to middlemanmovie.com, it will lead you right to the Kickstarter page, and you can see the teasers. It's also on YouTube. If you type in Jim O'Hare Middleman, you can take a look at some of these teasers. I think they're so well done, and it gives a great feel of what this film is going to look like. It actually almost looks like a period piece, but it's not. It's set present
right.
day.
Well, is it because of the car?
It's because of the car and because of the way Jerry dresses. Again, he's lived with his grandmother all of his life. He is not of today's world. He wouldn't know about Twitter and Facebook, and he would certainly not wouldn't know how to do a Vine or a selfie. You know, Jerry would have no Jerry, my goodness, Lenny, the character's called Lenny, would have no knowledge of any of that. So he is from the old days, but it's all set present day. So basically, you know, it's so funny because it's these, again, I get it, and I never down anybody who, I know money's tight for people and all that kind of stuff. That's why we're trying to make the incentives as exciting as we can to make it worthwhile. Because if everyone even just gave $5 who follows my Twitter or my Facebook, we'd be way up and over. You know, but to say just $5, that's not fair either. For a lot of people, that's a chunk
$5
of money.
I
get it. So I don't ever, but what we're saying basically is if you can't give financially, if you just help us spread the word.
That's a great thing to do. Jim, real quick, one last question. Is there anything else you want people to know about you and your career and your time here on Earth?
Well, you know what? I can tell you I've been incredibly blessed. I've had, and not just with the career, I have a family that is unmatchable, brothers and sisters, parents who are gone now but who never let me down as far as my dream was important to them, even though I don't think they understood it all the time. They were always at every opening night. They were always at everything I ever did. They were always there. And that kind of support is huge. The other thing I would also say is live your dream if you can live it. And I know it's easy to say because I've had a lot of, you know, good opportunities happen, but there was a lot of years it didn't happen. And I just stuck it out. And so I just always say stick it out. I'm not saying live in the street to make your dream comes true, but, you know, just keep your eye on the prize.
There we go. Everybody, it's been Jim O'Hare. His new movie is called Middleman. He's doing a Kickstarter campaign right now to fund this. Go click the link on the show page. Give $5, give $100, give $10,000, whatever you can afford to give, and we'll be right back after this. Thanks, Jim.
Garrett, thanks.
You've been listening to Rated G Radio.